This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
I'm Chris Prytower, and welcome to The Big Picture. I want to set the stage of where we're going to be heading today with several quotes from several financial luminaries. Here's the first quote. Stock prices have reached what looks like a permanently high plateau. That was Irving Fisher on October the 16th of 1929. Now here's our second quote. People don't realize that we cannot forecast the future. What we can do is have probabilities of what causes what, but that's as far as we go. I've had a very successful career as a forecaster, starting in 1948 going forward. The number of mistakes I've made are just awesome. There's no number large enough to account for that. I guess I should warn you, if I turn out to be particularly clear, you probably misunderstood what I've said. That was Alan Greenspan. Now, our quote number three is from the Federal Reserve. We don't expect significant spillovers from the subprime market to the rest of the economy or the financial system. The vast majority of mortgages continue to perform well. Past gains in house prices have left most homeowners with significant amounts of home equity, and the growth in jobs and incomes should keep the financial obligations of most households manageable. That was May 17th of 2007. The following year, January 10th of 2008, they said the Federal Reserve is not currently forecasting a recession. So here's Chuck Prince from Citigroup, the Citigroup CEO, July 10th of 2007. He said, when the music stops in terms of liquidity, things will be complicated. But as long as the music is playing, you've got to get up and dance. We're still dancing. Again, that was July of 2007. So the reason we're starting with this today is there are very smart people today, from CEOs to prominent economists to even our current Fed chairman, who don't see any problems on the horizon.
You know, the interesting thing about those quotes, and the reason we wanted to display a variety of them, is just like at the beginning of the year when we rely on forecasts, because we look to the experts and it's kind of like the weatherman predictions. I mean, they've been doing this since the days of ancient Greece, and we're looking for certainty in a world that is uncertain. And so anytime you get any turbulence in the markets like we did in 2007, where several of those quotes were taken from, we always look to the experts, whether it's a Fed chairman, a CEO. It's like, what are the really smart people saying? And so when they tell you, hey, there's nothing wrong, everything is okay, as Bernanke said, we didn't feature the one quote he had about real estate prices never go down. Well, they did for the first time, and they went down 40%. So we look at these experts for confirmation. Tell us that everything is going to be okay. And the reason I'm bringing this up is there seems to be a blatant detachment from the realities of the real economy today from public officials. Almost in one sense, Chris, an aloofness that borders on irresponsibility. I mean, with numerous signs everywhere you look, from a continuous trend in slowdown in housing, falling auto sales, contractions in the economies of Germany, Italy, and Japan. Then we have economic weakness in China to major weakness in retail sales here in the U.S. And just take a look at what we got this week. We got a bad report on the Philly Fed this week, with the survey falling into negative territory for the first time since 2016. And with weakening demand conditions, it had a drop in new orders and shipments, which actually went negative. And you always want to look at future shipments and orders, because you can have a weak report one month, but if you have strong order flow, that tells you things, that was an anomaly, things are going to get better. But when orders stop dropping, that tells you the months ahead aren't looking as good. We also got existing housing sales coming out this week continuing to decline. And for the first time, the conference board's leading indicators went negative in the month of January. So when you listen to what the Fed is saying, yeah, we're going to go on pause because of the turbulence, but they seem oblivious to these changes, and they still hold out the possibility. Notice that they said, well, we're going to go on pause. And there were several governors that said, hey, there's still the possibility of another rate hike or two. And there's also, well, when they're talking about quantitative tightening, they're saying, well, you know, maybe towards the end of the year, we'll be winding that down. So on top of that, you're also getting from the media criticisms of anybody warning of a possible crisis ahead as some sort of a Cassandra. Now, there are other economic measures out there, from a deceleration of corporate profits, which we'll probably see in Q1 here. We got a little bit of that in Q4. Everybody remembers when Apple reported they're going to miss their sales numbers. There's fewer stock buybacks. We're seeing declining global trade. That's backed up by a confirming index called the Baltic Dry Index. There's also an alarming rise in corporate debt, especially with the latest downturn in interest rates that we saw come about in the month of January. And, when the Fed says they're going on pause, rates drop, what you're seeing is a lot of corporations are running to the marketplace to refinance debt or finance new debt. There's also, Chris, something that we have a lot going on, not only just here, but around the country. There's a lot of social unrest. We see it everywhere, including the U.S., with the lurch towards socialism and discontent with capitalism, even as socialism is collapsing in, let's say, places like Venezuela.
Well, you've mentioned a few issues of concern. I mean, you brought up Venezuela. You talked about rising corporate debt, even the Fed possibly raising rates again. What do you think, Jim, are the riskier issues that are out there? I mean, and even the possible crisis triggers, like mortgage loans in the last downturn, that was certainly a crisis trigger, or maybe overvalued tech stocks, which happened in the late 90s.
You know, the one thing is we survey around, which is alarming, is a global contraction of liquidity. And why that's important is global financial markets run on central bank-provided liquidity. So anytime we've seen convulsions in the markets, you just take a look around and you can trace them back to central bank actions of one sort or another. They either said something or they did something, or they did something that was completely by surprise. The fact that 11 out of the 12 last recessions were preceded by central bank tightening tells you a lot about how crises unfold. Now, we've seen this occur, here's the problem, far too often. We saw it in the events leading up to the financial crisis of 2007. All throughout 2007, Ben Bernanke was reassuring the markets, as some of those quotes you read, is, hey, there's nothing wrong out there. Everything is looking good. My favorite one is the one they did in, I think it was January of 2008. We forecast no recession. The official recession began in December of 2007. So the Fed failed to realize the danger in the mortgage system with leverage and subprime loans, and we saw it with the taper tantrum in 2013. Again, this last December, with hawkish comments about rates following its fourth rate hike of the year. The real danger here is Fed policy is that they are withdrawing liquidity from the system by shrinking their balance sheet at the same time they were raising the cost of credit, which is a toxic combination. Now, they never done these two things since, you'd have to probably go back to 1937. So as we look around, we have central banks, several of them, are raising interest rates. The ECB has begun to shrink their balance sheet. They're no longer doing QE and shifting more towards QT. So we have gone from QE to QT. And what does that mean? It translates into less market liquidity, which poses a major problem in the next downturn. And why that is important, liquidity plays a major role in how our financial systems function today. That liquidity is provided by the expansion of the Fed's balance sheet. Now, that liquidity comes in two sources today. It's either coming through the banking system and the wholesale money markets. People don't realize how much those money market funds you stash temporary cash in play a role in the credit system, especially for short-term debt. They become much more important as a source of short-term lending, actually eclipsing banks as a source of funds to the market. And they've grown in size as a result of several factors. Hedge funds are using them, insurance companies, corporations with lots of cash. I mean, you know, you've heard these stories about corporations having $2 trillion of cash overseas. You've heard about companies like Apple that are sitting on $250 billion of cash. Where do you think they're keeping that money? They're keeping it, they'll loan it out to money market funds, and because they have to place that cash somewhere. They can't just let it sit aside, and there's not too many places you can do that. The U.S. is still the best place, because in Europe, on short-term debt, it's actually a negative interest rates. So you also have foreigners that are coming here because of our higher interest rate environment. I mean, if you take a look at it, a 10-year Treasury note pays 2.7%. A 10-year German Bund pays a little over 0.1%. So since this is short-term cash, which is used in the money market funds, they need to invest in short-term liquid assets because they have to maintain liquidity. When you put money in a mutual, let's say a money market fund, you want to be assured that you can pull it out if you need it. You're just putting it there. It's kind of like a temporary parking place. But with the shortage of short-term government securities, the private sector steps in with something that we call repurchase agreements or repos. These are basically asset-backed commercial paper. You have what is a credit system that operates through these repo markets with central bank participation. Now, the repo market bundles supposedly safe assets like, let's say, government debt like treasury bills, foreign exchange, high-grade corporate commercial paper, and then they use them as security in which to borrow against. The problem arises when credit conditions tighten, as they were beginning to do last winter, which is one of the reasons you saw a sharp downfall in a lot of these bond ETFs and mutual funds. Here's where the risk comes about. The risk arises of not being able to roll over or refinance that debt, because if you get a bunch of bad economic reports, there's a spike in volatility, credit spreads start to widen, what happens? Lenders kind of pull back the reins, and it makes it more difficult to roll over that debt. This was an issue that we saw in the crisis in 2008 when we didn't know what was safe at that time. And that's why the Fed and the U.S. Treasury and Congress had to step up with TARP and other programs to backstop the commercial paper market. It stopped functioning, along with the money market fund. The Fed had to backstop money market funds because they were going to break the buck. And I can remember, Chris, back in 2008, one of the listeners of our show was a produce broker here in California. And what he did is he used the commercial paper market to finance his operations. Normally, he would go in, issue commercial paper. It was usually for 90 days. He would use that money to buy lettuce, produce from the local farmers. He would ship it to the major supermarkets, and then he would get paid. 90 days later, he'd pay off the commercial credit and then take out a new loan. I can remember an email he got when things actually froze, when the commercial paper market wasn't working. And he said, if they don't fix this soon, you're going to see produce disappear off the grocery shelves. So that's how important this is. And when the problem surfaces, and it usually begins when the economy begins to weaken and liquidity tightens. When the economy weakens, what happens to creditors? They know that a lot of these lower grade credits are going to have some problems. Sales start to decline, profits start to decline, cash flow starts to decline. So the poorer quality credit becomes more risky and is subject to default. So when credit tightens and the problems arise, much of that short-term debt can't be rolled over. And that's where you really start to get the problems. Now, if we take a look around the globe, there's signs everywhere the global economy is close to sliding into a recession, unless central banks reverse course from where they are now, which is tightening, a coming crisis that could become much worse because you've got problems in emerging markets, you have a slowdown in Europe, you have a slowdown in China and Japan. In fact, if you look at Europe in the third quarter, Germany and Italy's economy went into contraction, Japan's economy went into contraction, and of course, we've been reading stories about China. Now, there's hope that this trade deal, which is one of the reasons the markets are rallying on this Friday when we're doing the show, that the trade deal will basically get resolved. And then as a result, trade will begin to flow again. Economies will pick up. And hopefully the markets are hoping that we see the word reflation instead of recession.
So why is it, Jim, that the experts like the Fed and other economists, they seem just to always get it wrong? And only after the crisis begins do they seem to even take action. Regarding this, I want to play a clip from the Wall Street Journal here, and it explains their current actions and current thinking.
The Federal Reserve voted to hold steady its interest rate on Wednesday. That wasn't a surprise. What was a surprise was what came out in the statement and the press conference that followed the meeting.
The case for raising rates has weakened somewhat.
How much? Well, if you compare the statement that the Fed released after the meeting on Wednesday with the one they put out when they raised interest rates in December, there were a lot of changes. The biggest one, the Fed removed language indicating that it might need to raise interest rates again this year. So they've paused. And it may be more than that. It may be that they've reached the end of the recent cycle of raising interest rates. So what did we learn from Wednesday's Fed meeting? First, the market volatility that gripped stock and bond markets last fall and in December mattered more to the Fed than they had previously let on. What does that mean? that means that the bar for the Fed to raise interest rates in 2019 is a lot higher than people thought that it was. Why is the Fed more concerned right now? The economic data in the U.S. really hasn't changed. First, global growth is slowing, and what happens abroad in the largest economies in Europe and China can spill back into the U.S. Second, political uncertainty is rising. It's not clear where trade talks between Washington and Beijing are going to end up. Neither is it clear how Britain is going to resolve its exit, the so-called Brexit, with the European Union. And finally, the government just completed a 35-day shutdown here in Washington. It's not really clear that what led to that impasse is going to be resolved in 3 weeks when government funding runs out again. All of this is weighing on Fed officials who have to consider how to set interest rates for an economy that may be slowing more than they thought at the beginning of the year.
In light of global economic and financial developments and muted inflation pressures, the committee will be patient as it determines what future adjustments to the target range for the federal funds rate may be appropriate.
Finally, the Fed made an important change around its $4 trillion portfolio of bonds and other assets that it accumulated when it was trying to spur growth during the financial crisis. They began to shrink those holdings in 2017 very slowly. But markets have been concerned about how long that process is going to last. And so the Fed on Wednesday provided an important update that suggested that they could be more flexible about changing the pace of the runoff and that they might end it sooner. The bottom line, markets are going to like what the Fed said and what Jay Powell did on Wednesday because it's much different from the way the Fed was approaching the world when it raised rates last December. It looks like the Fed is on hold for now. The question is, for how much longer?
You know what was interesting in that comment, Chris, that you just played, is everybody remembers what sort of took the market by surprise if we go back to last September when the Fed came out in its press conference and basically said, oh, by the way, we are far away from neutral. Was it surprising? The market peaked a couple days later and went straight down towards the end of the year. And then, of course, in the December meeting, when they raised rates for the fourth time, the Fed basically said, well, they project, I think they were projecting like 3 rate hikes this year. And then they said, by the way, our QT program is on automatic pilot. Then, of course, we ended up negative with the market reaching a low on December 24th. We saw what happened to the price of oil. And all of a sudden, voila, in the first couple of weeks in January, things flipped and they did a 180. Since then, we've seen the markets take off and the market has rallied strongly. However, what they're not saying here, even despite these slowing economic numbers, anticipatory economic numbers, leading economic index numbers, what they're not saying is we're done. Now, if they were to say, you know what, we're done with this cycle, we're at neutral, that would be one thing. But they're leaving the markets, they're leaving it open saying, well, we're going to be on pause, we're going to watch things, but we still might raise. And there was at least one Fed governor that came out this week that said, well, we're on pause and that's probably good right now, but I could see us raising rates later on in the year. So don't think that they may be done yet. So the problem, as it always is, the Fed is always looking at the rearview mirror, and they do very poorly when looking at, for example, anticipatory indicators, which always leave them in what I call a reactionary mode. A good example is their 180-degree flip in the month of January. And if you take a look at what's going on right now, last fall, when corporate profits were rising as they were in the second and third quarter, we had economic growth that was very strong in the second quarter, which was 4.2%. We came in around 3% last year. We're lucky, I think, if we have close to 2, it's probably going to be 1.5 for the fourth quarter and may even be less in the first quarter because we lost a little bit of ground with the government shutdown. So they got more hawkish and they raised rates 4 times instead of 3 as originally planned. They also cited no change in policy in December, and the markets reacted accordingly because there were already signs the global economy was cooling as a result of tightening, including our own. And that's why you got the severe reaction that you did in December, because the markets were saying, wait a minute, everything is starting to slow down. Things aren't looking good in Europe and China, Japan, and you guys are still talking tough. What the hell's going on? So the markets plunged, ending up negative for the year, and credit conditions tightened. And the 2 weeks later, we got the December lows. The Fed did a complete 180 in January.
Volatility is back. The stock markets are pivoting, the Federal Reserve is raising interest rates, and experts are predicting another recession. How will your retirement weather the storm? Are your investments fortified? Do you have a consistent source of income? Financial Sense Wealth Management can help you answer these questions and plan for the unpredictable. We monitor the markets, interest rates, and the economy so you can focus on doing the things you enjoy most. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management at 888-486-3939. Start planning, stop worrying, and make the most of your retirement. Call 888-486-3939 today. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
So as it stands now, global economic indicators are slowing down, including our own. So that brings to mind the question, is another rate hike coming? Or, Jim, do you think they're done? I mean, if things continue to deteriorate, is QE4 coming later this year?
You know, this is the thing that is probably most difficult when you're in the Fed rate raising cycle, because just as you saw in the month of January, where they completely did a flip, you really don't know what these guys are thinking. So much depends on what happens next. Now, if they stay on hold, or if the economy weakens further, the next thing you're going to hear about is reflation. But I doubt if the Fed begins to loosen until we're probably in the middle of a crisis or the economic slowdown accelerates. They tend to be reactionary, and they have to be aware that they don't have their chamber loaded yet, as they never got to raise rates as high as they were thinking. I mean, the Fed funds rate was close to 5% in the last downturn when Bernanke started to cut them. But that is due to the large amount of leverage in the economy, which we should discuss next, because quite honestly, that's where the crisis is most likely to erupt. Now, the banking system looks good, and that's why the Fed is feeling confident. But they're ignoring where the really big problem lies, which is in the corporate debt markets.
You know, in past shows, Jim, you've highlighted the corporate debt markets as being a problem area, especially junk debt and triple B debt. I'm curious, though, do you still feel strongly that this is where the problems will surface?
Yeah, I really do. I mean, with interest rates backing down, as we saw in the month of January, corporations are rushing to the debt markets. They're loading up. It's basically, you know, it's what homeowners do. I was talking to a mortgage broker, and as we got into, I think it was about right around October last year, mortgage rates got up to close to 5%. Now they're closer to 4%. So what are homeowners doing? What are realtors doing? People are rushing either to refinance, or if they've been waiting to buy a house and mortgage rates backed up, they were holding off. Now they're rushing into the market. We're seeing the same thing at the corporate level. I mean, you just take a look at some of the deals that have been done since the beginning of the year. Altria just raised $11.5 billion to finance its stake in e-cigarette maker Juul. Anheuser-Busch raised $15.5 billion. AT&T just refinanced $5 billion in debt. The company is sitting on a debt load of $171 billion. So we could see a record amount of corporate debt issuance this first quarter as companies rush to take advantage of the drop in the interest rates, figuring, quite honestly, the Fed isn't quite done yet. So Fed officials remain sanguine about the banking system, with banks being better capitalized, which they are, and before, let's say, the last financial crisis. Here's the problem. They seem oblivious to the fact that there isn't to where, let's say, the problem lies. It's the corporate bond market. You have a proliferation of junk and triple B rated debt. We've done a number of shows on this, but you know what? It keeps getting bigger. Right now, you have $1.3 trillion in leveraged loans. And by the way, leveraged loans have taken off in Europe as well. You've got $1.2 trillion in junk bonds. And here's the problem. You now have $3 trillion in triple B rated debt. Just to understand that, that is one rung above junk bond status. So with nearly a trillion of that, $3 trillion will need to be refinanced this year. They're going to have to roll that over. So as long as the markets are liquid, volatility remains low, that should not be a problem. But if we get a hiccup, as we did in November and December, that could become a problem. So as long as rates remain low, the economy continues to grow with no risk of recession, most of this debt can be refinanced, so there's not a problem. But if we get into a situation like we did in December, or let's say the beginning of 2016, it could become a problem. There is another issue, by the way, which is much bigger here, which is liquidity in the security of much of this debt. Now, in a situation that harkens back to the great financial crisis, a lot of this triple B rated debt has been packaged into securities wrapped up in mutual funds and bond ETFs. Now, similar to 2007, you had a plethora of bad mortgages that were basically folks' crap, bunched up together in a mortgage pool, and it was sold to the public as AAA and being safe. Now, we all know that debt exploded and investors lost large amounts of capital and what they thought were safe securities. I mean, there were a lot of fortunes that were made by some of these big hedge funds like John Paulson shorting this debt. We now have something similar in the investment-grade mutual fund and bond ETF market. You now have these low-quality bonds. Remember, BBB is just one rung above junk bond status, and many analysts, credit analysts, have looked at some of these BBB-rated bonds and basically said these really should be junk bonds. But they're illiquid, they're in portfolios, and investors think they are liquid, which is basically, I mean, if you own a bond ETF or a bond mutual fund, typically you can sell anytime you want, as investors did in the month of December. However, they become illiquid when markets freeze up, when a crisis erupts. Who will become the buyers if everyone panics and rushes to the exit gates at the same time, or worse, if a crisis erupts? That is when you find out who has been swimming naked as the tide goes out, as Warren Buffett is fond of saying. So in many ways, Chris, there are similarities to what went on in 2007 and 2009. Instead of mortgages, this time it's corporate debt, especially triple B. This is the risk the Fed doesn't see by withdrawing vast amounts of liquidity from the markets as they are now doing with QT. And if we just hearken back to the credit crisis, especially in the fall of 2008 when Lehman Brothers went under, what happened is the entire credit system freezed up. And that's what happens when you get these kind of panics or crises. The commercial paper market freezes up. The money market freezes up. And that's where, you know, a lot of these companies with so much short-term debt that needs to be rolled over, they can't do it. And you get into a crisis. And the only way we got out of that was with things like TARP, the Fed backstopping money market funds, commercial paper market. I think Bloomberg did an article that they were backstopping almost $9 trillion worth of various liquid traded assets or illiquid traded assets. And so that's what they don't realize. Yes, they've gone on pause, but they're still withdrawing $50 billion a month, $30 billion in treasuries and $20 billion in mortgages.
Well, you outlined really some issues of concern, Jim. I'm just wondering, you know, try to find the silver lining to this cloud. What do you think could change this outcome? And what do you think could prove your views to be wrong?
Well, another form of stimulus, either monetary or fiscal, with the government's budget. I mean, Chris, I have never seen in my years in the business where you come to the end of the business cycle as we were coming or heading towards in 2017, and the government enacts a $1.5 trillion tax cut, $300 billion in additional spending. Normally, you see that happen when you're coming out of a recession and the government's trying to re-stimulate the economy, as the Obama administration did, combined with Fed QE in 2009. You never see this at the end of a business cycle. And we have a couple of things coming up. The debt ceiling debate is going to be shortly upon us because we've exceeded $22 trillion in debt, as we covered last week. So there could be another round of stimulus similar to the $300 billion of additional spending they passed in January 2018. Remember, we're in an election cycle. The president wants to get reelected, as do members of Congress. So election year budgets tend to be expansionary, as politicians want the economy humming, as they love to promise voters lots of free stuff that other rich folks pay for. So you could see some form of agreement between both parties on, for example, infrastructure spending that could be massive. I mean, if they're going to talk infrastructure, folks, we're talking trillions of dollars. Then, of course, there's the Fed itself. Now, if the economic data continues to soften, if the economy continues to slow down, the Fed could send, let's say, an all-clear signal to the markets that they are done raising rates, and that could give us one last hurrah, very similar to what we saw happen in 2007 and the first quarter of 2000. But eventually, we're going to have another recession, and along with it, a bear market, not sure if it's the end of this year or next year.
Well, let's go ahead and boil all this down for our listeners to what it actually means for investors. Jim, what should our investors be doing now? What would you be doing?
Well, the first thing I would be doing is, if I owned an investment-grade bond fund, or let's say junk bond fund or ETF, is you really want to look at the fund or what the ETF owns. How much of it is triple B? Because there's going to be a lot of problems with downgrades if the economy weakens. How much of it is low-quality debt? And find out how much of the portfolio is in bonds that cannot be liquidated within the 7-day period. These funds have to report that to the SEC, and you should really know it, because if you're going to stay long these funds and a crisis erupts, you're going to want to be sure that you're not sitting on a lot of this toxic debt and you get hammered the way people did owning those mortgages in 2008 and 2009. You don't want to be sitting on that stuff when the fertilizer hits the fan. Now, one strategy, if you're a sophisticated investor, let's say, is to buy put spreads on high-yield ETFs. At least you're hedging them. Now, if you gradually sell off, another strategy would be sell off shares as they rise in this rally. Junk bonds tend to act like stocks. They go up with stocks, they go down with stocks. And because I can tell you, if you don't, during the next downturn, these funds are going to take a big hit, just as they did last October and December. Now, we're really in a place, and here's the thing that nobody can tell you. I've asked my experts on the program, and they'll admit they don't know. But we're in a place we have not been before, with so much money that has been raised in low-quality credit, much of which is illiquid. So the one thing you should make yourself aware of is the quality of the assets in your bond funds or bond ETFs. The one issue we do not know at this time, and quite frankly, nor does anybody know, what happens to all of that $3 trillion in debt, which gets downgraded in a recession, and funds are forced to sell that debt. And that's something that's really important. It's automatic. So let's say you're running an investment-grade fund. Your charter says you must only own what I call investment-grade bonds, triple B to triple A. Well, what happens when these triple Bs, which you own a ton of, get downgraded? You must, by law, be forced to sell them. Now, since most funds and ETFs own the same bonds, who are they going to sell them to? Themselves? I doubt it. Eventually, guys like us will be there to buy those bonds at a fraction of what they were worth. And we got to do this in 2016. We had, if you go back to 2015, the Fed raised interest rates at the end of the year for the first time. There was widening credit spreads. There was a big sell-off of energy-related bonds. And we went through, and you remember 2016, the markets went down every single week for 6 weeks. So a lot of that debt had to be liquidated. And guys like us that are liquid, you go into the market and buy them. And that will happen again. This next scenario, it could even be worse. If I was in the bond market, I would own individual bonds, because you don't have to worry. If you own short-term bonds, they mature, their quality, well, you can just sit on them. You'll get your interest rate. That's not going to change. And when they come due, you'll get your cash. But if you're on ETFs that have little exposure to triple B rated debt, then you're probably going to be okay. Because at the end of a business cycle, you want to be owning quality, not junk. Because junk can be very dangerous to your financial health. And I guess another thing I would say, I would also be owning short-term sovereign debt. Everything should be quality at this point, and not overly long-term, because quite honestly, we don't know how this debt cycle will play out. And we've never had this kind of debt levels. You'd probably have to go back to the Great Depression and World War II when debt levels were this high.
So, Jim, you've explained what you'd be doing specifically with bonds. What would you be doing with cash or even stocks themselves?
Lottery tickets. No, I forget what the size of the lottery is right now. But seriously, when it comes to stocks, I would be definitely looking at value over growth, dividends over non-dividend stocks. And if you know where to look, Chris, there's still a few places left where dividend yields are great and the values are there. Not too many places, but energy is one sector I would look at. You've got dividend yields there that range from 3.5% to 6%. There's even bargains to be had, and a few certain tech stocks are paying healthy dividends. And also healthcare is another area of the market. So at this point in the business and market cycle, stocks are expensive. And there are just not a lot of values in this market. So you can play this market on the long side if you're astute and know when to get out. In other words, you've got a lot of technical analysis background. Yeah, you've been a trader. Well, then maybe you can be long and you can see when things start to break down. But don't forget, even the best traders never picked up on what happened to the market in February of last year when one week we gave an entire year's gain in 6 days. None of the technicians we had on the program, and we had some of the best, none of those technicians picked up. And that's one of the things that you have to be very careful in this market with algo trading, is several of my technicians have said it's made life more difficult. So here's the point. We just don't know what will be the triggering event that sets things off. My gut tells me it's going to be in the corporate bond space and overseas, either in emerging markets or in Europe.
Well, given all that you've outlined, Jim, are you still approaching this market defensively?
Absolutely. I mean, there are a lot of smart people out there like Bridgewater that are doing the same. And when there are numerous brush fires, Chris, you never know when one of them turns into a conflagration.
Well, as we look out over the coming weeks, Jim, what do you see on the horizon?
Well, let me see. What do we have coming up? We're going to be getting into, well, not quite yet, but next month will be the end of the first quarter. So we're going to be following economic numbers. You have a Fed FOMC meeting. And remember, every FOMC meeting this year will be accompanied by a press conference. So we have the FOMC. The other big thing, Chris, is we have a debt ceiling debate. And hopefully we're not going to get into a government shutdown crisis like we did over the last one. And so we've got to look at that. And then, of course, towards the end of March, we are going to be getting, if there's any slowdown in corporate earnings, usually companies like to get the dirty laundry out the last couple of weeks before the quarter ends. So that's coming up in the weeks ahead. In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Prytower and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.